Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Susan Messer. Susan Messer has fiction and nonfiction published or forthcoming in Glimmer Train Stories, North American Review, Colorado Review, Creative Nonfiction, Another Chicago Magazine, Fourth Genre, Chicago Reader, KillingTheBuddha.com, and others. She has received an Illinois Arts Council Fellowship in Prose, an Illinois Arts Council Literary Award for Creative Nonfiction, a prize in Glimmer Train's Very Short Fiction Competition, first place in Moment Magazine's Short Fiction Competition, and a prize in the Jewish Cultural Writing Competition of the Center for Yiddish Culture. As a winner in Chicago Public Radio Stories on Stage competition, her story Wayfinding was read at Chicago's Museum of Contemporary Art and later broadcast on public radio. She has also been a finalist in the Chicago Tribune's Nelson Algren Competition, the Writers at Work Fellowship Competition, and Chicago's Guild Complex Nonfiction Competition. Hi, Susan. Welcome to Prosody.
Hi. Thank you.
How about we start out tonight with you reading a little bit from your work?
Okay. This is an excerpt from a story called The Stone Age of Intimacy. Arlene is a practical girl. I mean, she's down to earth, and she seems to understand all the things I don't. Everything from how to be the boss with your kids to pulling the starter on the lawnmower. And her husband's a handyman, so through him, she knows a lot about how things work. Once, one of the light switches in my house started to melt and send out smoke. I was scared, had no idea what to do, so I called Arlene. All I had to say was, "Smoke! Coming out of my light switch," and she ran over to check it out, no questions asked. She made a beeline for my basement, flipped the circuit breaker, came up, removed the offending switch, and that was that. She's a nurse, too, so any time a child on the block has a fever or falls off a bike and cuts their lip, Arlene's the one to call. She's got what I call comforting hands. And she always knows what to do, whether to use the ice or heat, one of the things I can never remember, whether to go to the emergency room or just lay low. What a relief to have her there. I guess she can be a real spitfire, too. You wouldn't necessarily know from talking to her, but I heard from her husband. One summer evening, a bunch of our neighbors were hanging around on the front lawn, just shooting the breeze. She was mad at her teenage son because he took the car when she'd said he couldn't. And to let off steam, she was making fun of him, filling us in on his secrets, how he goes through the house from one mirror to another, primping like a bird, checking his every angle, every hair before he'll even step out the door. We're all chuckling along with her in sympathy when the son pulls up. Arlene spots him and marches off to discuss the matter at hand. Meanwhile, Arlene's husband watches after her, shakes his head, says in a whisper, "Never mess with a little Italian girl if you know what's good for you." I never thought of her as a little Italian girl before, but there you are. She is a little thing, that's for sure. Anyway, she's lived next door to me for 2 or 3 years now, lives with her husband, second marriage for him, second marriage for her, her teenage son and a young daughter. Her husband has kids, too, but they live with the ex-wife. They've also got a dog, Ralph, a big, sloppy, barky one that gets upset and spouts off when anyone walks by. Arlene says that the dog doesn't like hats, so watch out in the winter. Why a dog would have anything to say about hats is beyond me. But pest though he is, Ralph somehow adds to the party spirit of that house. People always coming and going, neighborhood kids eating popsicles on the back porch, dogs coming over to carouse in the yard, phone ringing off the hook. Arlene and me sometimes talk over the back fence. We're not bare your soul friends, but I can't think of anyone I'd rather have around if I were in trouble. Like I said, I admire her practical grasp of things. In a wave of affection, I once told her how happy I was to have her for a neighbor, and she just looked at me and laughed. I do know a secret about her. When everyone else in her house is asleep, she goes downstairs, turns on the TV as a cover in case anyone else comes in, and she prays. I know because I often wake in the middle of the night. I don't know what rouses me, but there I am, bug-eyed, just can't settle back down. So I give up, get out of bed, and wander through my house. And more times than not, I see that ugly blue television light radiating out from the back room of Arlene's house. I hate that light. It's just a cold beam of loneliness. And if I look out my kitchen window just so I can see into her back room, our houses aren't far apart, and I can see Arlene standing in front of the television, rocking gently from front to back or side to side, her hands clasped in front of her, her head bowed, the fingers woven together, telling secrets to her hands. Believe me, I've wondered what someone like Arlene would want enough that she'd pray for it. And of course, I've got my theory. She's finally got her life in the shape she wants. A good house, a jolly husband, a smoochy dog, her kids doing well in school, no problems with her ex, no problems with his ex. So she prays, "Dear God, just don't let anything change." The end of change? Anyone looking for that is doomed. One summer afternoon, I come outside carrying a big brown grocery bag of garbage, and Arlene's sitting on the top step of her wooden back porch. She's wearing plaid cotton shorts and a faded purple t-shirt. Her bare feet rest on the lower porch step, and she's got her knees together, feet apart, which gives her a knock-kneed little girl look. Like I mentioned before, she's small, and her straight, chin-length hair with bangs that grow down to the brow line add to that look. Still, her skin is on the leathery side, thick, tough, and her eyes have a puffiness around them that says, "Heavy mileage." I deposit my garbage in the can, come back toward the house, and we get to talking about the weather, the kids. Somehow I get into telling her about an article I just read, how this guy wrote a whole book trashing Mother Teresa. "Imagine that," I say, "trashing the only saint we've had recently." Not that this guy didn't make some good points in his book, like how Mother Teresa pretended to be above politics. She'd go to someplace in Central America where a million Indians had just been slaughtered and claim that all she could see was the peace of God around her. Then 2 minutes later, she'd be preaching that abortion was the worst sin in the world. Of course, everyone's entitled to their opinion about abortion, but these days, when you talk about abortion, you're talking about politics, no matter what you want to call it. So I'm telling Arlene about this guy who trashed Mother Teresa, and she says, "I wonder when the last time was that he did anything for anyone," which is probably a good point. The thing on my mind now is this. A few nights ago, Arlene comes over and rings our front doorbell. My husband's reading the mail, and I'm upstairs making the beds. When I hear the bell ring, I come down, and Arlene's standing in the front hall, her eyes so big she looks like she's seen a ghost. She seems hesitant, like she doesn't quite know what to say, which is unusual for her because she's always straightforward with her words. So first she says, "I just thought I'd come over for a chat. You weren't busy, were you?" But the whole thing's fishy because maybe we talk over the fence, but we almost never go into each other's houses. And I say, "No, I was just upstairs making the beds." I joke, "It's 7:45 at night. I guess it's about time to make the beds." But she doesn't laugh. She just stands there. So my husband tells her to come on in. Still, she keeps standing in the front hall, her feet pivoting a bit like she doesn't know which way to turn. And I start to wonder if she's drunk or something, but I know she doesn't drink. Then she says, "Is it okay if I use the phone and you don't ask me what it's about?"
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Susan Messer. Susan, in this story, I was really drawn in by the choice of the narrator because it's got this real, beyond the fact that you're kind of curious, like, who is this person that's telling the story and the people around it? It's got a real kind of that neighborhood quality to it, you know, the comings and goings of a particular area, and it's very specific to that area, but at the same time, I think all of us can kind of relate to, oh yeah, there was that kind of voice in our neighborhood. It was kind of the exchange of the stories. And so I just want to ask you about the choice of this narrator, like how it came to you and what was interesting to you about her.
Mm-hmm. It really did just come to me. It's not a voice I usually use. It has a very chatty sort of, chatty. I mean, she's a chatty narrator.
She's kind of the newspaper of the
environment. She's watches everything. She knows what's happening. She's very curious and, bordering on gossipy perhaps. And, really, this story started with the title, which, The Stone Age of Intimacy, came to me one day as an idea about how unevolved we really are in relation to intimacy, how we can brush shoulders with people all the time, talk across the back fence, talk about issues in the world, even inflammatory issues like abortion, political, moral, ethical issues, see them all the time, get little insights, peek into their back window, but really know very little about them and not know how to ask and not how, and that Arlene, there's clearly something is happening with her, she doesn't reveal it, and as the story continues, they, even though this thing has happened in the house, they dance around the fact that something has been revealed. Arlene has revealed that there's a problem, but by asking, not to, please, can I use your phone? But you don't ask me what it's about. She's set a limit.
Right.
She's revealing that there's a problem, but she's not going to reveal what the problem is. And
that makes sense that the narrator came out of that, because it's, that's the other side of it. There's a, in living, maybe it's a bit more old-fashioned idea than today, with so many people kind of moving from one neighborhood to another, which is, part of contemporary society. But there, I think, still is this implied sense of connection in neighborhood, but really kind of exploring, like, well, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. What are you learning about the people around you? Is it just like when they buy their groceries and if they watch TV late at night and, versus the kind of connection you think you might have with them.
Well, or true intimacy. I know in the neighborhood where I live and where so many of us live now, we're so close together. I mean, the houses in my neighborhood are very close together. You really can see into people's, back windows if you look, and if they don't have their curtains closed. And so we know a lot about each other, and yet we don't. And so I was playing with that idea of intimacy and the limits of intimacy, living in such close quarters, yet being so shut out, really, of each other's lives, knowing only such a small percentage of what is really in people's hearts. And so I chose a, to get back to your question, a very chatty narrator who knows a lot about people's business, yet still that essential connection of true, I don't know, that true intimacy is ends up to be missing in this story.
Well, and it's got to, as a writer, it's got to be a really intoxicating voice. I was jotting down, some of her words like jolly and schmoochy. And it's just like, she's got a great vocabulary, It's like, you just want to listen to her for a while. But it is that really, it's that chatty voice. It's someone who's, the words she's using are almost, they feel to me almost like they're tastes. Like there's something that you're really like, oh, yum, So that had to have been fun to work with her a little bit.
It was. I enjoyed that voice a lot. And actually, I was just remembering it when I presented this story in a workshop once, when somebody said that perhaps Arlene would have been particularly uncomfortable revealing something to this narrator because she seems so chatty and who knows where else it might spread.
Sure.
On the other hand, Arlene chose to come to their house and kind of, it's this tantalizing, line that, she reveals something but doesn't reveal. And I mean, she could, why not go to the 7-Eleven or,
Right. Apparently she left her cell phone at home.
Exactly. Yeah.
But it, I want to talk about this a little bit more a little later, the idea of secrets, and kind of what's under the surface of things. You know, if she has a secret and it's her choice to go somewhere, you know, maybe to pick this person to reveal the secret, but then only reveal so much. And again, it's just another level of intimacy, mm-hmm. how much you want anybody to know about you.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Susan Messer. Susan, will you read a little bit more?
From something different?
From whatever you like.
Okay. Let's see. Now, again, a longer piece or a shorter or what?
I would do one that's about probably that 5 minute
about that
range.
Same
yeah,
range.
About that.
Okay. I'll read an excerpt now from a story that just came out in Glimmer Train called September Song. Two sisters stand in the dim light of a hospital room. They are tiny women, less than 5 feet tall, smaller than size 5 shoe. The younger one, Renee, has a silver streak in her close-cropped black hair and no jewelry, while the older one, Janine, wears cat-eye glasses, New York auburn hair, and complicated earrings. A man, their father, lies in the bed, head on the white pillow, closed eyes, wisps of white hair, bruised and punctured arms so thin and weak. Lines and wires lead to tubes and dripping bottles. Monitors display graphs and blinking lights. The hospital's name is stamped on his thin gown in a repeating red and blue pattern. Providence, 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 Providence. His wrists are restrained in soft terry cloth bands near his waist. I hate the bands, Renee says. She imagines the torture of having her own hands restrained. Look at him. What damage could he do? He bit through the ventilator, Janine reminds, just yesterday. But he's still alive, said Renee. He opens his eyes, and when he sees that both his daughters are beside him, here from the West Coast and the East, he gives them the mother of all eye rolls, taking in the full meaning of their presence. Had he not always been the one to fetch them at the airport, flight numbers and itineraries posted on the refrigerator for weeks in advance? He tugs at the wristbands, his hands in a fist. Lymphocytic, the nurses say as they come and go, and pneumocystic, and now sepsis. He closes his eyes. No one knows how much longer the small ups, but mainly downs, of the crisis may continue. So the sisters stand, one on each side of the bed, and each finds a patch of hand among the wires and tubes. Renee wonders whether the father likes the touch of their hands, or whether, judging from his twitches and shudders, the touches irritate him, torment him even. What might he want? What might ease him? But here is Redempta, the nurse, the one who knows everything. She wears an extra-large pink uniform and has long, thin hair, grayish-brown, pulled into a small bun at the nape of her neck. The women and their father are in good hands with her. When the father opens his eyes, Redempta leans over him. She places her fingers lightly on his chest. She peers into his face to assure eye contact, and she says in a loud, clear voice, "Just nod if you mean yes." Then, "Would you like me to raise your head?" He nods. She raises his head, and this calms him. She checks the lines and monitors. "I can remove the restraints if you plan to stay a while," Redempta says to the sisters. "Your father would like that." "Yes, then," Renee says. But she is afraid, because as soon as he is freed, he explores the tubes with his fingers as if he might pull them out. He kicks at his blankets. "Now, now," Redempta says. She holds his hand firmly in both of her large ones, calming him again. She takes Renee's hand and presses it between her own. "Tiny," she says. She places Renee's hand firmly on her father's, and she leaves, though the daughters wish she would stay, since she knows what to do and they know nothing. So the father dozes, and the two sisters stand in the long silence of the hospital vigil. A monitor beeps. People pass in the hall. The sisters look at each other, then down at their father, asleep. Janine has brought sprigs of fresh lavender to help with sleep and dreams, of rosemary to help with melancholy, and of wild mint to remind their father of his garden. She wafts them around him, runs them under his nose beneath the plastic oxygen clip. He inhales deeply. When he wakes, he is agitated. He complains that his pillow is wet, and the daughters try to calm him like Redempta did, testing the pillow, adjusting his head, pressing his hands. But the daughters lack the nurse's confidence, and he recoils from their touch, reaching again for the tubes that feed into his arms, the clip in his nose. An idea comes to Renee, a distraction. She nudges her father's arm and points to her older sister. "Would you like Janine to sing to you?" she asks. "She has a beautiful voice." Renee imagines that if their father could hear a beautiful voice, it might salve his anxiety. It might keep him from doing damage. Janine looks pleased and surprised at Renee's words. The two rarely compliment each other. Because of the tricky balancing act of siblings, suffused, as the relationship will always be, with needy childhood, with reluctance to jeopardize any slight advantage by acknowledging the other's talents. Renee has certainly never praised her sister's voice before. To be honest, she has often felt irritated with Janine's singing, when at random she bursts into song, making a mad grab, it seems to her, for the family spotlight. But now, she thinks, the situation is desperate. A mad grab may be in order. Their father doesn't respond. "Would you like her to sing to you?" Renee repeats. "She has a beautiful voice." The father stares at his younger daughter with a puzzled face, screwed up brows, rheumy eyes, mouth looking to form words. He's a good man. He has lived an honorable life, modest, devoted, hardworking, but he is known for saying what's on his mind, at times with a heedless bite. Lena, his wife, had often warned him to choose his words to the children with more care. "Go ahead and say it," she'd tell him, "if you never want to hear from your daughter again." But Lena is not here now, gone more than 10 years, and the father stares at his younger daughter with that twisted look. Renee feels a slowly creeping, scared, spreading like an ink blot. She imagines that he is rallying to ask those censored questions stored over all the years.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Susan Messer. So I'm really glad you read that piece because it plays right into a question I want to ask, which I love it when that happens. And it has to do with kind of a couple things. One, at the beginning of the story in Glimmer Train, and people would have to get a copy of it to see that because radio hasn't gone visual yet, you have to submit a picture of yourself as a child, and you have a little piece in there underneath it about being a child and having worries, being worrisome.
Right. My career as a worrier began at an early age, is how I said it.
Which I love. And I started thinking about that in terms of not just this piece, but in several of your pieces, the idea of kind of, it's not always worry. I would say maybe sometimes it's attention, sometimes it's concern. There's kind of this subtext. And then, you know, over it are the actions, the kind of things that happen, details about people. And then somehow these worries or these concerns kind of, they sprout up like the person doesn't want them to, but they just do. So I just want to talk about that a little bit since you've had such a long career as a worrier. and you know, is that one of the ways that sometimes a story comes to you? Is like, is it something that draws your attention in that kind of way?
Well, it probably is, actually, that, you know, my kind of going upon my about my life and something sprouts up that unsettles me in some way, whether it's, you know, I mean, I do tend to be an anxious person, it's true. And
I think a lot of writers are.
Do you?
Yeah, I do.
Whether it's something that arouses my anxiety or just interrupts the flow of things. I noticed in those two pieces, though, I mean, this is a little bit off the track of your
That's
question,
okay.
But I noticed, I don't think I've ever read those two together, but in the first piece, the narrator is saying that there's all these things she doesn't know what to do about that Arlene knows what to do about. And in the second piece, Redempta, who's also a nurse, Arlene is a nurse. I'd never realized this before. Arlene in the first piece is a nurse, and she knows how to do everything. And Redempta is the nurse in this piece, and she knows how to do everything. And the, you know, main character is like, you know, so thrilled to come upon somebody who knows how to do everything. So I guess my narrators feel somewhat inept.
Yeah, I was going to say, or the moral of the story is always travel with the nurse. The other thing I think is, and it ties back into the other story, is that, of course, I think most of our secrets are worries. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't keep things secret that most of the time that we just think are really delicious and we want to keep them for ourselves.
Right.
Most of the time what we're doing is we're keeping something that we're worried about and definitely worry about revealing. And, you know, in this story, there's such vulnerability, you know, kind of all the way around for all of the characters. And it's not just about the vulnerability of being a man in a hospital bed, you know, we're assuming on the verge of dying.
Mm-hmm.
But even the vulnerability of the sisters, you know, I love that observation about, I don't think you read that part of it, but where the whole sibling negotiation, you know, that at given times events will happen that you have to kind of step over the, I remember when you used to make fun of me when we were six kind of thing.
Yes, yes.
And I, you know, it's kind of, again, like the other story that had the kind of narrator, the surprising kind of chatty neighborhood narrator that brings you in at a different angle. In this story, it's the, you know, there are these elements that you would think, well, okay, we're just going to deal with the loss of a parent. But the story is really looking at other things. It's looking at how that is a catalyst for concerns that each of the sisters have. And then there's kind of this nurse walking in. And it's really, you know, those moments of, you know, I think in kind of the tradition of fiction, it's like the moments of crystallization. But in your work, it's more like these moments of concentration, and everything doesn't necessarily become clear. If anything, it just all kind of converges.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the characters kind of grapple with that, which I find, you know, really interesting. And because I don't want stories to solve problems for me necessarily. I want them to make me think.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to thank you so much for coming to Prosody. You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a bi-weekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineer is Joseph Wilk, with special thanks this week to Daryl Jones and Electric Mayhem Studios in Chicago. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, Independent Public Radio, 91.3 WYEP. She had a smile that swerved, she had a smile that curved.